Well, welcome everybody. This is Tom Sparrow moderating our call today for the Storytelling and Organization Group. And today we have the pleasure of Dr. Joan Hoxie with us. And her session today is entitled, What If? And just a little bit about Joan's background. She has worked with quite a variety of organizations throughout her life, with United Way, the Diocese of Youngstown. She was executive director of the Lorain County, Ohio's Family First Council. And she worked with a multi-million dollar program for young children and family in Cincinnati. She's a practitioner of appreciative inquiry and a champion of the VIA Character Strengths Survey. She is the principal of a company called Relationship Resources that she and her late husband, Michael, started. She is also my mother-in-law. And I
don't hang up. Don't hang up, everybody, please.
I refer to her as my mother in love, something she and some of our other family members had brought to us, because it's love that brought us together, not law. And I'm excited because over the years we've just shared so many stories and talked about organizational work in so many different ways. So it's a pleasure to welcome you to the call today, Joe. Good to be with you.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Dear son in love. what a nice thing. I'm just so pleased to have the opportunity to talk a little bit about my work and I think maybe the world in general, and to talk with people who practice storytelling and who appreciate storytelling. I couldn't help but think about a story when Geraldine was sharing about doing this book for her daughter, who's a new mother. I've done an awful lot of work with children and families, and one of the projects even that I headed up here for the county was a program called Help Me Grow, which was a program for little guys, 0 to 3, and their families. And in the course of that, I've had quite a wonderful opportunity to do a lot of training. And I was thinking of a story, that's not a storytelling thing so much as it is a story about the work I do. I guess that I'm more than a little appreciative of the value of stories. I remember doing an after-school program, and my children were all very young, and that a good story would last much longer than any lesson I tried to impart with the kids or to the kids. So we did a lot of play acting and a lot of storytelling, and I've always thought that was a really wonderful way for people to learn, and so I appreciate all the work that people like the folks on this call are doing. But I thought of a story about myself, actually, that made me kind of giggle in terms of training. And as I said, I've done an awful lot of training. So one of the trainings that I did for several years was what they call a service coordinator training. And what we were trying to do there there was this big network of service coordinators, people who actually worked with the families through home visiting. And so that the training curriculum really looked at, what you might do to make yourself more comfortable and to make the people with whom you were visiting in the home more comfortable. And so we got to that part of the curriculum about, the idiosyncrasies of certain families and what to do and what not to do and how to not be upset. And I said to this group of about 30 women who were all service coordinators, You know, I think it's really important when you go into a household or when you go into somebody's home to sort of observe what's going on there and to kind of pitch yourself in a way in the same culture so that you're not, I don't want you to be too overwhelmed or to feel that people are, you know, speaking poorly or to make those judgments. Just kind of roll with that. And I said, you know, for instance, language is really, really important. It's an important way that all people use it to express themselves, of course. And I said, sometimes you walk into a household and their culture is very different than yours, and as a result, their language is very different than yours. And I said, you know what, the first time I went to Ireland, I was just amazed. I couldn't get over that everybody from the grandmothers on to the kids all said, "Fuckin'." They would say, "That's fucking brilliant," or "That's fucking beautiful," or "That's a fucking good thing." And I would just go, "Oh my God, they're all saying fuck." And so I must have had a physical reaction as I was saying that, because I later heard from some of the folks that were at the training that every time I said fucking, I turned red. And so as a result, I got a cheering group of trainees who would say to me, and almost as one voice, "Say it again, Joan, say it again." And so for the next couple of hours that we had the training, I did a lot of fucking. And at the end of the training, of course, we always had we always had evaluations. And I had a partner, a parent who had these services in a previous time. And she would go through the evaluations, all of which went to the Department of Health, the Ohio Department of Health. And I didn't look at them very well because I'm a little leery about evaluations. Especially in that circumstance, but Pam looked at them all the time, and she said, "You have to look at these." And I said, "Well, I will, okay." She said, "Especially this one," and she handed me this piece of paper, and it said, "This was a fucking good workshop." And I, you know, I wondered if I'd ever hear from the Department of Health again, if they would ever hire me, or if I'd get some sort of reprimand from them. I never did. But I share that story in the notion that I think story, you know, my story over the years, I've told that story to the point where I don't get red when I say it anymore. But I tell that story and people get a little sense of who I am and who they are in relationship to me, and it's always sort of leveled the ground. Another story of the same ilk is the story of that sort of, again, I think sort of puts a hallmark on my work over the probably 40 plus years I've been doing organization development work. And it's another training. And I got this wonderful suggestion through a book done by the director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. And I, to save my soul right now, I can't remember his name. But he would do a music camp every summer. And as the kids came in for the first session of the music camp, he would say to them, "I want you to draw a big letter A on a piece of paper." And everybody would do that. And then folks would say, "Well, what's this for?" And he would say, "This is your grade. This is the grade for this summer workshop. And I want you to tell me how you're going to earn that grade. How are you going to earn your A?" And I loved that. I thought that was just so great, because people come into trainings, they come into workshops, they come into work every day with a little, you know, uneasiness about what the day is going to hold. So I've stolen that. I used to say I adopted it, but I really just stole that. And when I do a workshop, I often use that as the beginning of the workshop, have everybody do an A, and then I ask them, "Well, I tell them that that's their grade, and then I ask them how what they're going to do to earn the A and what I'm going to do to earn the A. And about 5 years ago, I had a group of child care workers that we were going through this training, and we got into a conversation after I had done the A exercise, and I said, well, you know, we really do a lot of stuff to earn that A, and we have a lot of symbols that we think of in terms of what we do to gain the A. I said, you know, can you give me any examples of anus?
Yeah. Yeah, you wanted everybody to celebrate their anus, right?
Mm-hmm. And I made it much, much better because as that word came out of my mouth, anus, I said, oh, shit.
Oh, God.
So, I believe in storytelling, mostly on myself, but I think stories often, you know, lay a truth out there that is pretty, that could be pretty hard to take. Most of my work has been, in fact, I can't really think of a time when I wasn't looking to help people to claim their individual and their collective strengths. It's one of the reasons I became a practitioner of appreciative inquiry, which looks for what works and builds on it, as opposed to looking at what's wrong and trying to fix it. And it's really, I think, an offshoot, or it actually existed before positive psychology, but I think those two things have been a wonderful, wonderful addition to organization development work. And so I'm always looking for stories that I can make that point without, you know, being too much of an academic or, a therapist or all those other things. I want people to be able to pull their own learning out of what we do. And so I often tell this story, which is much more of a story. So there was this monastery in a forest, and beautiful, beautiful monastery that had fallen on really hard times. There were only, I guess I should ask Tom, do you want me to do this now?
Yeah, go ahead, and then we'll talk some more.
Well, we're back to the monastery. Everybody visualize the monastery in the forest, and it had fallen on very hard times. There were only five monks left in the monastery, the abbot and four brothers. And so they had a community meeting one day, and they were just bemoaning the fact that, you know, they had no new postulants, no new novices, and they didn't even have people coming to pray there very much. And so it was sort of a downtrodden kind of meeting. People were very uncomfortable and pretty much in grief. So the abbot, hoping to sort of raise the spirits of the monk, said, you know, there is a rabbi in the town next to us who is reported to be very, very smart and a very visionary person. He comes out to our little hermitage in the forest every once in a while, and I think the next time he comes out, I am going to go and talk to him, and I'm going to ask him for some advice about how to build our monastery back up. And so it happened that the next time the rabbi came to the came out to the monastery grounds, went to the hermitage, the abbot went to call on him, and they had a lovely afternoon. They had drank tea and they talked about the world and just everything. And the abbot thought to himself, well, this man certainly is a very learned person, and surely he'll have a way for us to build the monastery back up. So he said, well, Rabbi, before I leave, I have to really ask the question I came for. He said, give me some advice on how to rebuild the monastery and the ranks of the brothers. And the rabbi said, I don't give advice. I have no advice for you. He said, but I do have one thing to tell you. He said, the Messiah will come from you, will come from the monastery. And they wished each other goodbye, and the abbot went back to the monastery. And, of course, the brothers were all a-twitter because they wanted to get this information about how they were going to change and grow and be a big institution again. And so they asked the abbot, well, what did the rabbi say? What did the rabbi say? And the rabbi said, well, or the abbot said, it's really kind of funny. He said he didn't give me any advice. But he did tell me this one thing. He told me that the Messiah would come from this monastery. And all five of them were really perplexed. What did that mean? So they thought about it in the next few days, and Brother Timothy said, oh, he said, you know, I think it's Brother Elrod. Brother Elrod is a very kind and loving person, he said, but he's kind of a ditz. And he said, could the Messiah be coming from him? Well, maybe. And so Brother Elrod is thinking along the same lines that Brother Timothy was, and he's thinking, oh, my gosh, the Messiah is here, one of these. He said, must be the abbot. The abbot is the holiest of all of us. But he said, maybe not. Maybe it's Brother Joseph. You know, he's very quiet, but he's also very pious. Maybe it's him. And got to Brother Joseph thinking about the same thing, and Brother Joseph said, well, I bet it's Brother Tim. He's the organized one. He's the one who always gets us taken care of and gets our meals taken care of and does all that. Must be the Messiah. And then Brother Joseph had this just incredible thought. He thought to himself, oh my gosh, what if it's me? What if I'm the Messiah? Oh no, that couldn't possibly be the case. So for the next several weeks, they started asking that question, who's the Messiah? And they started looking for all the reasons that one of their brothers might be the Messiah. And pretty soon, there was just this kind of wonderful atmosphere in the monastery among the five monks. And some young people in the town had heard that there were this small group of monks who were very, very holy and had good advice to give to people. So some of the young people started to come out and talked to the brothers, and some families came out and had picnics in the woods, and some of these young men that were having conversation with the monks began to actually want to come into the monastery. And by the end of the year, there were 100 brothers in the monastery, and the monastery had grown back to its original fullness. So the question is, what if we treated each other like the Messiah? What would happen? I use that story because I love the fact that the first thing it does is calls up this sense of looking at other people's strengths, looking for the goodness in people, because we so readily look for and find the difficulties that people cause. And it's very hard to appreciate that sometimes, or to appreciate the goodness. I don't know who it was among you that said, when my child turned one, I thought I needed to have affirmation because I kept from killing her or having her get killed.
No, and kept her alive.
You kept her alive, exactly.
I didn't kill her, I kept her alive.
Well, I wanted to kill a few of my six at one time or another. What I'm saying, I think, is, and that story brings about a wonderful discussion about what does it mean? What if? What if we treated each other as though each of us were gifted?
Mm-hmm. Oh, my. Oh, Joan, that's so powerful. I think we're all just sort of reveling in that wonderful statement, what if? I know I am. It's just made me put a smile on my face. it made me smile and think. Thank you for sharing that.
You're more than welcome. I love sharing that story. I love seeing the smiles that come from people because they all recognize, I think, in their own ways, individual ways, that they are special and wonderful, and that's what organization development is really about. If from my perspective, what we try to do when we go into an organization or into a group is to say, before you do anything else, look to your own gifts. Look at them personally and individually, and then look at the gifts. You know, it's a wonderful question to ask of your group, of the storytellers. You know, what is it that you bring to the world that is so special, and you can hold your head high because you do that? And you are that. You're more than just doing it. You are it.
Joan, talk a little bit about the way it would look to pose a question like that of, you know, does it happen in pairs or small groups, or what are some of the ways that you've facilitated some of those discussions?
Well, normally we tell that story in the context of saying to people, you are something much more than you think you are, and this organization is so much more than you think it is. And so we typically start with pairs, and we do an interview. And it's a pretty extensive interview in that we give people at least an hour, half an hour each, to talk to one another about not just the stories, we hope that by the sharing of the story, we've percolated a little, you know, we've got the pot boiling a little bit so people are not too uncomfortable about sharing their goodness. In fact, I typically say, without being humble, name your best qualities. And then without being humble, how have you contributed to this organization? And what are the best experiences you have? And what strengths do you hold? And so there's a little guide that we use, and it's never the same guide because every organization needs a little something different that speaks to their organization. So we often start sometimes we start with the mission statement or the vision statement of the organization and ask them to talk to each other about how they believe that they're living in the mission of whatever the organization is. And the interesting thing has been over this long, long period of time that's so unexpected. And every organization that I've ever worked with, you know, from tiny, small groups that are doing some specific service, you know, to one of my clients is supply chain company that has huge companies all over the world, not just the country but that they are trying to, and that brings up a really, I think, a kind of nice thing that happened with that group. The CEO of that company said to me, you know, the people who are most in touch with what we do, and he said to his group, you know who's the most in touch? And he said, it's the people who work on the loading dock. And he said, if they don't do their job, we totally, our whole chain falls apart. And he told me later on that what happened as a result of their doing this appreciative inquiry, that they had all kinds of people who were going out to the loading docks just to say, you know, thanks, good job, or, you know, we really appreciate you. It's the story of keeping your child alive. I just love that. I had a cousin who had this wonderful tradition started in her family that she sent her mother a dozen roses on her birthday, not on her mother's birthday, on her own birthday. So in a sense, that's what we're trying to get people to do in a maybe in a more systematic way. I don't know.
Yeah.
Most humane, main thing I know that we do.
Mm-hmm. Are there any questions for Joan at this time? We can take a little pause for questions.
I want to know if people know stories that they could tell me about, you know, people seeing the goodness in one another.
This is Drea. I remember, oh, Lord, it wasn't Power of Positive Thinking. It was much later, but it was a book in that same line where the I'm telling you vaguely of an anecdote that may have not have been true anyway.
Great opener.
Welcome to
storytelling.
We love that.
Yeah. But the anecdote was that these people went into a classroom and told the teacher, "We've got this, you know, please have your students take this test. And, you know, it's an aptitude thing. We'll let you know the results once everyone takes the test." And so the kids take the test. And they get the results, and they pretty much just throw them out. And then tell the teacher, you know, pretty good group. Doesn't look like you've got anyone, you know, really falling behind. But these five, wow, they're on fire. And, you know, the teacher was looking at the five names and going, "Hey, one of those men, really, man, you'd have to light a fire under this one guy." But, well, they must see something. That test must have shown something that I haven't seen.
Right.
And the test scores, and of course, the grades of those five students started going up and up and up.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then it's kind of like, oh, that makes me sad, quite frankly, for everyone else in the class. Like, oh, no one else had that special star. But at the same time, I don't know how you get that to where you tell the teacher, "Man, you've got a bunch of Einsteins here. Just keep going." But it just reminded me of this. Yes, when you point out the positive grows.
Yes, absolutely. What you focus on is what you get. That's one of the principles that just appears to be very, very true. And we know it from lots of different places, you know, from the sports world to educational kinds of things. There was a very big study done where they actually traded classrooms. They had separated kids out from one another to the low achieving and high achieving, and they told the teachers for those classes that that's what they had. So one teacher was told that they had low achieving kids, and they were actually high achieving kids, and the low achieving the teacher was told that they were remarkable. So it was so the experience was so profound that it took the kids who had been told that they were they weren't told, but their teacher was told that they were low performing. It took about 3 years for them to gain back, and they stopped the experiment because it was so damaging to the kids that were perceived as low achieving.
Human studies.
I'm sorry?
Human studies.
Yeah.
So
it's, we're not just talking about some sort of niceness with one another. We're talking about something much more, I believe, much more profound, in that we actually search for and give people the opportunity then to experience the highest point of their experience, as opposed to the lowest point. There are lots of energy studies that are beginning to really bear all of this out, and of course the new the new studies around how the brain works are very interesting in terms of, you know, actually producing serotonin and all of that sort of stuff. So good stuff.
There's a couple of things that I wanted to make sure we covered today, Joan. And one is to talk a little bit about the VIA survey.
Sure.
And the other is, in the description that we had, I'll just read, it says, seeing the possibilities in others and in oneself is fundamental to any organizational change. And also that you put, you know, that this is not a superficial thing. It's not, you know, the soft skills, it's the real stuff. And I was wondering if you might tie those two things together, a little bit about the VIA and a little bit about why this stuff is fundamental.
I'd be happy to. I'll do the best I can. Well, the VIA is VIA. It was originally called the VIA because it was called Values in Action Assessment, and they shortened that, as we do it in lots of things, to this VIA thing, and now it's just called a VIA. It's an assessment of character strengths, and it's huge in its research base, in that the initial idea was that there needed to be some sort of description of what we call sanities, S-A-N-I-T-I-E-S, sanities, as opposed to insanities, which there is a huge volume every couple of years that's put out. It's called a Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Illness, the DSM, and I think they're what, on the sixth now, DSM-6? And they're used, the DSM is used by all therapists. If I wanted to, as a therapist, I wanted to get paid by an insurance company, I had to put one of these diagnoses from the DSM in the paperwork, the insurance work that was done to get paid. So in 1980, Martin Seligman was the new president of the Association of Psychologists, the APA. And it's the prerogative of every president of the APA to create an initiative. And so Marty said, what I want to do is I want to really focus on the second aim of mental health, or of the APA. He said, most people don't realize that when the APA was founded in the late 1930s or 40s, early 40s, we had two goals. One of them was to treat mental illness, and the other one was to research and help people claim the good life. And so he said, we got overwhelmed as an association and as a field of practice with the mental illness thing, partly because people coming back from the Second World War had experienced all kinds of horrific things, and while we didn't call it PTSD then, we knew we had lots of work to do in mental health. So I'd like to refocus the association to this research and this helping to people to lead the good life or understand what the good life is. And so he put that charge out, and there were lots of people who were very interested in that. And one of them was actually a person here from Cincinnati, Neil Mayerson. Neil and his wife Donna are both practicing clinicians. And if you're from Cincinnati, you know the name Mayerson because they have a huge foundation here. And so Neil had just been called away from his private practice to head this foundation up about the same time that Marty Seligman was sort of putting this charge out to look for ways that we could help enhance people's experience of the good life. So it was a very casual call, actually, that Neil made to Seligman to say, let me know if I can help you. And of course, Seligman was very much interested in what Neil might be able to provide. So they thought at first that what they needed to do were some studies on adolescence. But it became clear when they brought a whole group of psychologists and psychiatrists together that what they really needed was some sort of list or book or lexicon of what it is that they're talking about when we talk about the good life. And so they hired probably the most renowned researcher in the country, Chris Peterson at the University of Michigan. And he and Seligman spent about 3 years doing a cross-cultural study of virtue. And so what the essential question was something to the effect of, you know, what does this culture claim as virtue? What does it mean to be virtuous in this culture? And from that, they got six virtues, and from the six virtues, there are 24 strengths that lead a path into that virtue, and that are exhibited when people have that virtue. And everybody has them. That's probably the thing I want most to express, that everybody has these 24 strengths. We just don't have them in the same order as others do. So what we've discovered in the 20 years or so since this study was done is that the good life is also the virtuous life, and that there is that what gets between people is often their strengths, and that they rub one another raw, or a person only believes they have one or two strengths and they use it for everything, or it's the fact that people have not spent time and energy looking at the whole 24. So, and it's just amazing to me the difference between having people use that assessment, which you can do for free at via.org, is people's acquaintance with their own strengths and their ability then to look for others. It's the same thing as the monks. You know, they began to claim their own stuff and as well as look at others. And so what the Via Strengths stuff does for folks is to help them, first of all, to look at what do I have in terms of these character strengths, and what do I what strengths do others with whom I work, and do we hit what they call the golden mean, so we don't overuse or underuse our strengths. And that can be a challenge, you know, to begin to look at how I use my strengths, and do I depend only on one or two, or do I look at the full range of strengths. And what we find is that people oftentimes, when they are in a stressful situation, other strengths come forward. It's kind of interesting. They call them situational strengths. Mm. So it's been just wonderful for me, at least, to work with people in terms of helping them to see that about themselves and to see that in others. Huge, huge help in team development. Mm.
This is Tricia, and Joan, I just find this fascinating, the situational strengths that just caught my attention, and I could see a whole genre of story being developed around.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Individuals or children. I mean, that's just so interesting to me, the situational
and Tricia, to put an exclamation point behind that, I'll give you an idea that these strengths are a picture in time. They're not, you have all 24 of them, but you don't have them in the same sequence all the time. There are usually about five that you have that are pretty consistent. Mm-hmm. But I've just been, my top strength for a long, long period of time, and I loved it because it said so much about, to me, about who I was. It was an appreciation of beauty and excellence. And I could look back over my lifetime and see how that strength had done me well and explained a lot of things. So I've just been, in the last few years, I've been through 2 years, or a little more than 2 years, probably more like 4 years altogether, 4 or 5 years, the caregiver for my husband who passed away recently.
Yes, I know.
And I took the assessment again, and my top strength is perseverance. Hmm. And it blew me away because that's the strength I had to call on. So it's wonderful in terms of the what if. What if I really knew my own strength and I really knew the strengths of my companions, my colleagues, and what if we really knew what our business or our association or our group had in terms of strengths. So we know that there are groups who it's the combination of all of the strengths that they have as an organization, but that's all about who the individuals are. And so you can really see how an organization moves forward because they have people who are able to do every bit of or be every bit of what it takes to keep an organization going in that direction. It's fascinating stuff. Mm-hmm.
It is.
I think.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Joan? We're coming up on our 45 minutes of our phone call, so just open that up if anybody has a question.
I should tell you that Geraldine and I do this work together. yeah. And I would suspect, Jer, I don't know, that your book came sort of out of that idea. Your book for Kateri came out of that idea of honoring other people's experience.
Yeah, that would be a good description. One of the reasons, anyway.
So it's VIA.org.
VIA.org. Great. Well, I think then, Joan, is there any other thought that's running through your head that you want to share with us as we get ready to close?
Well, I don't know how many of you have contact or have some responsibility for children, but I would just sort of make this plea that lobby those who have responsibility for our kids to begin to look at what they are doing right as opposed to putting so much emphasis on how they're failing. We know that when people begin to experience their strengths, that we get a different kind of action. It's just natural. It comes because the brain secretes actually a chemical that allows us to have more energy. And so I would just ask people to begin to think about that. And if you have any influence in preschool, kindergarten, grade school, high school, college, that we begin to look at our kids from, and I don't mean that in a soft way, but I mean it in terms of appreciating and challenging people to use their strengths, particularly kids. I think we're in a bit of a crisis where that's concerned in the world.
Agree.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Joan, for taking time to talk with us and share some stories. And
share any stories with me or through Tom that you come upon that kind of are in this lane, because I'd really like to collect that and put a book out or even just some prompts for people to be able to say, well, this is where we're starting, and these are stories of how people have changed or what they've done as a result of being told that they have strengths.
Will do.
Great.
Thank you so much, Joan.
Thank you. I appreciated it very much.
Yeah, and Joan, I'll meet you all someday. And Joan, if somebody wanted...
It was a good workshop, Tom.
Yeah, that was. Just your... remind us of your email. It's joanhoxie@gmail.com. Is that right?
That's the best one right now.
Yeah. And that's... Okay. Hoxie is H-O-X-S-E-Y.
Hoxie.
Yes.
You better say yes.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining the call.
Yes. One thing I just realized when I was reading the updates, it's Jules here. I got to see Andrew Tarvin. I was I saw him last week at a meeting with the association I've been part of, and it was bugging the hell out of me why his name was so familiar. Okay, so I saw your email, and I saw him. He's actually quite good. He's got an interesting style, but he does tell the story of how he got into this work. So he talks about his process as well as what he does. His topic for us was like using humor at work, and it was only for a dinner meeting, so it was only about 40 minutes tops. 30 to 40 minutes, but he's a quirky guy, but he's very good at what he does, and he seems to be making tracks quite a bit. So I just wanted to give you that feedback now that it finally clinched why this person sounded so familiar.
Yeah, and if anybody who's listening, Andrew Tarvin is going to be our pre-conference workshop facilitator, and he will be talking about humor and story and work. This summer at the NSN conference, 2017, June. That's next month, almost this month.
Well, around the corner.
Yes. Good. So I think the leadership team is going to stay on for a meeting, but everyone else, thank you again for joining us, and thank you so much, Joe. Really appreciate it. Fucking good.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye now.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks so much. Bye.